From the hallowed halls of Flood Law, via the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building, this is Behind the Bench on News Talk 760 WJR. With your law expert, Todd Flood. Brought to you by Flood Law. Flood Law, when it matters. Visit floodlaw.com. Now get ready with your legal questions for one of the Great Lakes' leading attorneys by calling 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0WJR. Now here's your host, Todd Flood.
We're back. It's been a quick month, so a lot to cover. We have a special guest coming on tonight, award-winning investigative reporter from WDIV Channel 4. Kevin Dietz is coming on tonight, and we're going to talk a lot about White Boy Rick. White Boy Rick is the longest-serving nonviolent juvenile offender who is basically been denied at every step of the road here to determine whether or not he can get out, both on his appeals, and then it went to the Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, see if he could be resentenced. It was determined he couldn't. If you all remember, White Boy Rick was sentenced for life without parole under the delivery of 650 grams of cocaine or more as a juvenile. He had quite a history to this case. Movies have been made or are being made about it. I understand that there was a documentary that was done here in Detroit, sold out for the weekend, and there's a lot of views on this case. Now he is being basically it's being determined whether or not he can have a parole hearing. The parole board has denied him twice. And now it's, I understand, coming up again for a third time, which he is now eligible for parole. At one point in time, the law was if you were prosecuted and convicted of delivery of over 650 grams of cocaine, it was life without parole. That law has been changed for juvies because the statute was determined to be cruel and unusual. And even though it was determined that, the parole board has basically rejected him and his parole. So, a lot of opinions one way or the other on this case, and clearly, someone that knows everything there is from the beginning to the end, Kevin Dietz. Kevin, you with me?
I am, Todd. How are you tonight?
I'm great. Thank you so much for coming on. And talking about it, you have covered this story from the beginning, and in Detroit, you're probably the expert on what's happened. So, give us a little backdrop. How did White Boy Rick get put in the position he was in from the very beginning? What were the facts of the story?
Well, Rick Wershey, at 14 years old, was a informant for the FBI. His father.
Oh, I think we lost.
Drug game in Detroit City Side. And the police would basically pay him for tips to find out where the drug deals were going down. And he collected about $35,000 over the course of a couple of years. And then the police stopped using him as an informant. And he decided to get into the drug game himself. And he quickly was able to obtain large quantities of cocaine, and within about a year of being a drug dealer, he was busted by the police with 8 kilos of cocaine, which is enough to get you a life sentence in Michigan. He was only 17 years old when he was arrested, but he was charged as adult and convicted and was sent to prison for life. Ultimately, they decided in Michigan that that was cruel, that's cruel and unusual punishment to away from Thunder, which he was and is. On a life sentence with the possibility of parole, but only if the parole board approves it. And he has been in behind bars now for 29 years. He went into prison at 17. He's now 48 years old.
Wow. So it sounds, I mean, from those facts, and it was groomed almost in the beginning at a very young age, working for the police and doing buys. Why did this? Why did the police, if you know, why did the police stop using him if he was successful in making the purchases?
Two things. One, Richard Wershey was shot when he was 16 years old, and the police who were using him as an informant, it wasn't on the books. They were using his dad's informant ID number, and the money was going to the dad, and the kid and the dad were splitting that, but the kid had more information than his dad. So when Rick Wershey got shot, it got real hot. It seemed that people thought maybe it's not a good idea that we're using this minor off the books to get information.
That's
the
crazy.
The other reason is, that's why Hollywood's making a movie about it. It's pretty hard to believe. Wershey says it's true. There's some FBI receipts that we've obtained that show that payoffs were made to Wershey. We had receipts that we obtained that showed the FBI gave Rick Wershey $1,000 in cash, paid him, bought him tickets to the Tommy Hearns Marvin Hagler fight in Las Vegas, bought him plane tickets, and
at
sent 16? Him to Las Vegas as a 16-year-old kid, 15-year-old kid,
15. Wow.
to stay close to the drug dealers who were attending the fight. And he did that. And when he came back, he brought back a lot of information on a gang called the Curry Brothers, who were operating on the east side of Detroit. And shortly after that trip to Vegas, the feds busted the Curry Brothers. And that was the extent of the inside knowledge Rick Wershey really had. So they no longer needed him as an informant anymore either. So they didn't really need him anymore. It was getting dangerous. And it's a wild story of this kid who was a white kid in an all-black neighborhood who had found himself close to drug dealers as basically an errand boy. And the feds paid him for tips and used him to help make major busts. And then he became a drug dealer on his own when he ran out of the tip money. He had dropped out of school, had no job. He had done buys for police. And so he tells me that's what he knew. So that's what he did. And it didn't last very long before he was busted.
And
the story gets even wilder once he's in prison, because the feds go back to him once he's in prison and they say, you know, you're a state offender here, but we can put you up in a cozy federal prison if you agree to help us go after dirty cops in Detroit. And he agreed to help them. And what was going on in Detroit at the time is drug dealers were flying drugs into City Airport.
Right.
And they were able to do that because the Detroit police would make sure they didn't get busted.
What year
and
was
so,
that?
This was 1982, about.
Wow.
Early 80s. He was, he had a girlfriend by the name of Kathy Wolfson, who was the niece of Mayor Coleman Young. And the feds were very interested in knowing more about Coleman Young. They were constantly investigating Coleman Young, and they thought maybe Richard Wershey could help them in their investigation. He introduced his girlfriend, Kathy Bolson, who was Mayor Coleman Young's niece, to an undercover cop, and they came up with this plan to ship in drugs from Florida to Detroit. And Kathy Bolson got her friends and some relatives who were police officers to help make sure these drugs made it into Detroit, and they were all busted.
Wow.
And one was Coleman Young's bodyguard. One was his brother-in-law, Coleman Young's brother-in-law.
All get and charged, Kathy, Kevin?
All got charged. Kathy Wolfson was arrested but not charged. The bodyguard, Jimmy Harris, he went to prison. Willie Wolfson, the Coleman Young's brother-in-law, he went to prison. And Coleman Young at the time went on television and called Richard Wershey a stool pigeon and basically put his life in grave danger in prison. So Richard Wershey immediately moved to the federal system, went into solitary confinement, and was moved out of the state prison system, where he continued to to help federal agents for many years moving from prison to prison, trying to get information on different inmates who were behind bars. All at the time, it was just to have a better life in prison because he was in prison for life without parole. But then suddenly that changed, and there was possibility for parole, and they wanted him to continue helping, and he did. And he gave information on a very famous Detroit homicide cop named Gil Hill.
Kevin, if you could, callers want to jump in and ask some questions. This is unconscionable. I mean, this shocks the conscience and that standard of entrapment. I mean, but this is just amazing. Can you hang on? We'll be right back.
Absolutely.
After this. 1-800-859-0WJR, 1-800-859-0957. We have one of the best investigative reporters in the state right with us tonight, telling us a fascinating story about the infamous white boy Rick. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Behind the Bench, radio's most comprehensive legal forum, where you ask the questions and Todd Flood provides informal counsel. Submit your legal questions at 800-859-0WJR. And get to know Todd Flood at floodlaw.com. Now, here's Todd Flood.
We're back. So, joining us, we have with us perhaps one of the best investigative reporters in Detroit, and he is a wealth of information. When he dives into a story, he covers it from A to Z, and tonight you can tell he has been following white boy Rick, and it's an honor to have him on the show tonight. Kevin, have you had to or had many opportunities to talk to? I've seen you interview him, white boy Rick. Have you had many many opportunities to talk to him in person?
Yeah, I've been up to Manistee, Michigan, where he's in the Oaks Correctional Facility, and have met with him face-to-face. We've gone over his story, and then, you know, taken notes. You can't bring a camera into the jail, but take notes and then come back and try and determine if, you know, what he's told me is true and if it bears out. And he has FBI agents who back him up and Detroit police officers who back him up. And his story checks out pretty much.
So you've corroborated that he's been telling the truth.
And one thing people often...
I lost you there for a second. I lost you there for a second. One thing that you were saying, people don't, and that's where we lost you.
Am I back?
Yep, you're back.
Okay. Yeah. So one thing that's real important, but he has an existing record behind bars in prison, except for one huge mistake he made, and it's important that people know about it because when he was behind bars in federal prison, he phoned his sister with someone who could get her an automobile on the outside. And his sister and this person on the outside ended up being part of a car theft ring. Mm. And the feds busted this ring in Miami, and they were going to charge the sister, and they were going to charge Rick with a crime for charge Rick for putting these two together, charge the sister for what she did, and then charge the bigger crime ring. Rick, at the time, for life, without parole, agreed to plead guilty if his sister would not be charged. So his sister was not charged. They let her go. They cut her. And he pled guilty to two felonies. And that could be a reason why he's still locked up. So it's an important part of the story that doesn't get told often. When he gets out of Michigan prison, he still owes 23 months of prison time in Florida for his role in connecting his sister to that car theft ring.
So if he is paroled, he has a consecutive sentence that he would have to serve down in Florida. They're not doing it concurrently?
Well, they will.
I lost you.
He will have to go down and serve it. His attorney has said if he's in Michigan, they'll ask.
Kevin, I think we lost you. You must be in a bad spot, and we'll try to hook back up with you real quick here and call you back, see if we get a better connection. So if you have questions for Kevin, 1-800-859-0WJR, 1-800-859-0WJR. You know, therein is an amazing story. Think about it. You groom a 13, 14-year-old to go into the undercover world for selling drugs. You're the law enforcement agency that's making that happen. He then, in turn, gets several, it sounds like, successful prosecution and convictions. And because he gets shot and the spotlight is put on him, he is clearly unconscionable. I mean, you got a kid that is in the drug warfare and gets shot. They decide not to use him. But then, in turn, where's the path for this guy to go on? All he knows is the drug trade. In turn, he gets up, gets busted. White boy Rick, for selling and caught up in drugs, gets sentenced to life without parole. The law changes, wherein he then can get parole, but is denied these parole hearings. He's denied his parole. I don't know. I think we may have Kevin back. I'm not sure. But, Kevin, you with me?
Yeah, can you hear me better?
Yeah, I can hear you a lot better. Sorry about that. So, the lawyer for his case that he picked up while he was in prison for this auto theft ring, it's amazing, you know, kind of the double standard here. Someone, three people get hooked up in the ring, and they let one person off as long as he takes the hit for it. Well, how many people did he get busted that he's received no credit for, it seems like? It seems to me to be a little bit imbalanced. I mean, if that's all true, hasn't the parole board taken into account how many successful busts he's taken off the street? And then when we left the segment, and we get callers calling in, but when we left the segment, you had said he got a famous homicide police officer, Gil Hill. How did he help nab Gil Hill?
He provided information that Gil Hill was taking bribes to cover up homicides, and the FBI started investigating that, and they set up a sting operation, and Gil Hill did not take the bait, and Gil Hill was never charged. And at the time, Gil Hill went on TV saying, "This Rick Wershe is a liar. I've never taken anything from anybody," and he was never charged. But Gil Hill knew that Rick Wershe gave information that led to a sting operation that was not successful. So he had an enemy in Gil Hill, and he had an enemy in Coleman Young.
Wow.
How that translates to the parole board, I don't know. The way it works is you're supposed to get, every 5 years, you're supposed to get a review and an opportunity to have a parole hearing. And he's had one hearing in 28 years. That was in 2003, was his last hearing. And they had a public hearing. Kid Rock came to it and testified. People testified on his behalf. The FBI came and said he's one of our best informants we've ever had. He's
wow.
led to dozens of police officers going to prison. You need to let him out. And the very next day, several Detroit police officers came in and testified, no, this kid was dealing so much cocaine on the streets of Detroit, he needs to stay right where he is. And they had a vote, and the parole board voted to keep him in. And then when it came up, they wouldn't even give him a hearing. 5 years later, they wouldn't give him a hearing. 5 years later, they wouldn't give him a hearing. And now here we are in 2017, and it's time to decide whether or not to have a hearing for him again. And that vote comes up on April 14th.
Wow. We have a caller that wants to ask you a question about the case. His name is Robert. Are you willing to take it real quick?
Sure.
Robert, you with us?
Yes, I am, Todd. This is for Todd or Kevin, for either one of you. I know the Michigan Constitution says it's cruel or unusual punishment, where the federal Constitution says cruel and unusual punishment. Why can't he go to federal court and say that the state Constitution says that this is, the standard to be lower under the state Constitution, that this is unusual punishment? I'm being punished unusually here.
Well,
He has.
Yeah, Kevin, I think you told me he has gone up through the federal system, and Cincinnati right now is requested basically why he can't have a hearing. Is that where he's at right now?
Yeah, the federal judge in Michigan said no, there's no evidence of cruel and unusual punishment here because they have not said that he can't get parole. They're just saying they're not going to parole him yet. He has life with the possibility of parole, and they're not going to parole him at this time, but they will consider it in the future. So the federal judge in Michigan was not favorable towards Richard Wershe, so it went to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said, no, you're going to have to explain why you haven't given this guy a parole hearing in all of these years. And that case was scheduled to take place in Cincinnati last month, and it was postponed or put on hold because right now the parole board in Michigan is having this vote to decide whether or not he gets a parole hearing. So if they vote not to give him a parole hearing this time, it will immediately go back to Cincinnati, where the state of Michigan will have to explain why this kid has not gotten a public hearing and a chance at parole.
Robert, great question. I think the nuance there is simply that, first, the Cincinnati court has remanded it back to, or asked for a hearing with the parole board. If they deny or don't have the hearing, then I think they examine your question about the disjunctive and or, where the Michigan Constitution says one and the federal Constitution says obviously the difference. So is the statute that we have in Michigan, as you have phrased it, Robert, is it constitutional? Does it meet and pass the test? And can the state meet the burden under strict scrutiny of basically saying what's the benefit in weighing that to the state of not or having a different phrase within our unusual and cruel punishment? Thank you, Robert, for listening and calling in. So, Kevin, when is the... you said that they're making a determination right now of when they're having a hearing, or is that scheduled?
So last month, the head of the parole board met with Rick Wershe and in a one-on-one meeting, and he put a report together on his impressions of how that meeting went and gave it to the rest of the 10-member board. So on April 14th, those 10 members will vote up or down on whether to give him a parole hearing.
Wow.
If six people say he deserves a parole hearing, then he gets a public hearing. And if that happens, then people will be able to come and testify on his behalf on why he should be released. People can come and testify on why they think he should stay in prison, if they think he should stay in prison. So we'll know on the 14th whether or not he's going to get that public hearing or not.
Talk to us a little bit about who he is as a person as you interviewed him. He seems to me that he had no hope after he gets shot, after he gets dumped by the feds. And they don't want the spotlight around them of putting a youngster in the harm's way, but yet still want the fruit for what she can get. They kick him to the curb a little bit, and because they don't want to get in trouble, obviously. And what he didn't seem to be didn't have any other trade in his back pocket except for the hustle drugs. So he's in this spiral. But you get to interview him on several occasions. What is he like as a person? How does he come off to you?
I'll tell you, he admits to what he did. He admits that he was moving a lot of drugs for a short period of time, and he admits that he should have spent time in prison. But he says from the age of 14 to 16, he was cooperating with police and helping police to put drug dealers away. And when he was arrested and in prison at 18, until current, he has been working with federal agents and with law enforcement to put drug dealers away. And that every time he's been asked to help cooperate, to help bring in other criminals into custody, he has done that. And he feels that he should be rewarded for that, that when you cooperate and help, it should reduce the amount of time that you spend in prison. But it seems to him that every time he tries to cooperate, in his mind, it's leading to him spending more time in prison instead of less.
Right.
He feels like the people he cooperated against, he feels like by cooperating against high-level people in Detroit, somehow that's influenced the parole board not to let him out.
Wow. So in the federal system, we have what is called a departure under a 5K1, where you get credit for cooperating or helping the feds. In the state system, we don't have that tool. We don't have that mechanism, which obviously this is a perfect story for why judges and prosecutors should have that in their arsenal to allow when people have basically, you know, they've served their time, they've paid their punishment, they've faced their consequences, and then in turn help. They should get, as we have in the federal system, some credit. We are taking calls 1-800-859-0WJR, 1-800-859-0957. We'll be right back with Kevin Dietz for one last segment with Kevin. It's one of the most fascinating stories and a blockbuster story coming out in Hollywood, and was a sellout in Detroit for the last showing of White Boy Rick. We'll be right back after this.
If you're seeking counsel, get to know Flood Law's Todd Flood. Call the office during business hours at 248-547-1032 or visit floodlaw.com. This is Behind the Bench on News Talk 760 WJR. And now, here's Todd Flood.
We have an incredible story and show with Kevin Dietz. If you want to see one of the best, tune in to Channel 4 WDIV. Kevin is an investigative reporter, been in Detroit, and has handled some of the biggest cases in our state and has unfoiled and unraveled a lot of cases where the truth has been found. And his work is stellar. And as always, with the facts that he has and corroborated on this story, no wonder it's a bestseller. Kevin, tell us, I didn't see it, but I understand it was sold out here in Detroit. They had a documentary this weekend or last weekend?
Yeah, so this story has caught on really around the world, but Hollywood has become fascinated with it. There's a couple different projects going on. What went on this weekend was a documentary by a Cleveland producer named Sean Reck, and he went around and found everybody who was connected to this story and got them on film and talked about their role, from the Curry brothers, who were the drug dealers who Rick Worship worked for, to the FBI agents who did the operations that that Worship helped bust from behind bars, to the FBI agents who used Worship as a teenage informant, along with journalists and other people to tell this incredible story. And it premiered this weekend during the Free Press Film Festival to sold-out crowds. And then there were panel discussions afterwards. And what will happen now with this documentary is it'll most likely be picked up by either HBO or Showtime or Netflix, and then will be redistributed for everybody to see in a few months once that deal gets finalized. The other big project is Hollywood movie. Sony Pictures is making a blockbuster movie that's going to come out January of 2018 with the star Matthew McConaughey playing the starring role as Rick Worshi's father. And they decided the starring role was really to the father to look into how a dad could have his 14-year-old son become his sidekick informant. While the dad was informing the FBI about gun sales in Detroit, the kid is informing Detroit police and the FBI about drug sales. And they chose the time of Rick Worshi at 14 to the time he goes to prison at 18 to focus on the story that they're doing. And they're filming right now in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where they're filming this movie. And there's several Oscar award-winning actors and actresses playing in this movie. And Sony expects it to be their biggest picture of the year next year.
Wow. Wow. I heard Matthew McConaughey, you say, is playing the father in this case?
He is. And McConaughey, on March 16th, it was in Detroit filming some scenes in the East Side neighborhood where she grew up. And they're filming some scenes on the People Mover. And when that filming was done, the next morning, he drove up to Manistee, Michigan, to Oaks Correctional Facility, and he met with Rick Wershe for over 5 hours.
Wow.
to help him in his role playing the father. So he also went and had a face-to-face visit with Wershe in prison.
So is the father still living, or is the father...
No, the father is deceased.
When did he pass?
He died. The mother is still alive. I saw her this weekend at the film preview at the Detroit Institute of Arts, and I spoke with her. She, of course, feels terrible about all of this. She divorced her husband, and that was the time she moved out to Shelby Township. When Rick was 14, she tried to take Rick with him and did for a while, and he did pretty well in school while he was out in Shelby Township, but he wanted to live with his father, and he moved back with his father. And that's where everything turned bad for Richard Wershe Jr.
Hey, and talking to the law enforcement officers, the FBI, the officers that came to his parole hearing and testified for him the first time, are all of those FBI agents and law enforcement that testified for him, are they still living or...
Yes, they're still living. They're still willing to testify again for him if a parole hearing comes up. They have written letters to Governor Snyder asking for a pardon. They have written letters to the parole board on his behalf asking for his release. They've been willing to testify, and they've all given sworn affidavits to try and help Wershe get out of prison. He's on year 29. Again, arrested at 17 as a juvenile, nonviolent, longest nonviolent juvenile offender in the history of Michigan, and cannot get a parole hearing.
Wow. So, as he's turned away every time from parole, obviously Governor Snyder has not done anything with it. What about any other, like, for example, advocates from DPD or from his... You know, when he went to where he grew up, any of the people that when he was up in Shelby Township, has he received just an amazing amount of support from our local PD and our at all? And from
the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office has objected to his being released over and over again, going back to Mike Duggan when he was the Wayne County Prosecutor. In 2003, when the hearing was held, he wrote a scathing letter saying that Rick Wershe was a danger to society and he should not be released. Jim Worthy has continued that feeling, objecting to his release whenever asked. But recently, she was the U.S. Supreme Court said that juveniles across the country have to be looked at again, and they were talking about juvenile murder cases. And so as part of that, she had to go back and review all these juvenile murder cases to see if any of them deserved parole after the lengthy sentences that they've had. And in doing that research, she has now decided that she's no longer objecting to Richard Wershe being released.
Oh, really?
She's not going to jump in and help him necessarily, but she says if the parole board decides that he should be let out, she will not object to him being released, and will just stand on the sidelines now. So that's a major change, and that just happened in the last 6 months.
That's an interesting development because, under the first-degree homicide cases by juveniles, the Montgomery case and the statute in Michigan that basically changed the LIFER law is that the first round of review is to the individual prosecutors in that county who put the person behind bars. They give their first review, and they can reject. If they reject, then there's a hearing. But that's for murder. This is a the non-violent offense. It's the delivery of drugs. Now, don't get me wrong. Obviously, you know, insane amount of violence happens with drugs. But the homicide cases, clearly, someone died. So if she is saying, hey, listen, I'm going to stand to the sideline on this case with where she then, that's a huge development, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. I think that's a game changer. And when she made that announcement, things really started moving with the parole board. He was not expecting to even hear from the parole board until December of 2017. And he heard from them in January 2017 after Kim Worthy had made her decision. And that moved everything up. So then he had his meeting with the head of the parole board. And now he's written those reports and it's gone out to the full 10-member board. I would be very surprised if this time around the vote is to not give him a public hearing. I think he's going to get a thumbs-up vote on the 14th of April, and he's going to get that public hearing, which would take place in June or July. And at that point, when they go to call people opposed, there are no real individual victims for a drug dealer. It's not like a murder crime where there's family victims to come forward. So the people who would come forward are the police and prosecutors. And if the top law enforcement officer on the case is standing on the sidelines, it would bode well when other FBI agents and law enforcement officials say this kid has done nothing but cooperate in putting other drug dealers and dirty cops behind bars. It would seem he would have a very, very good chance of getting parole this time around. But he thought that 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 15 years ago, and he has still behind bars. So it's cautious optimism at this point.
Right. So two things. One, few things. One, is he well-read? Is he educated? Did he get an education? Two, what is he... does he have hope?
Yeah. He's gotten his GED. He's graduated high school. He's very well read. I don't know. You know, he has no further education than that. But as part of this process, you have to go out and show that you would have a safe place to live if you were paroled, and that you would have employment. And he has numerous job offers. If he gets out,
wow,
where he will be gainfully employed. He has offered multiple offers of places to live with reputable people who will vouch for him and provide him a place to live. So he's got a place to live and a job, and that's a big hurdle. He's met all the other criteria to be released. He thought he was going to be released in 2003. He went through all of that process, and they went and did a home check and did all the other things to make sure that he had a job to go to. And then suddenly the script got flipped and he didn't have the votes in 2003 and he didn't get paroled. So I think that's the stage we're in now. They're looking at where he would live and where he would work and how he would be a member of society that's beneficial and not a danger to people.
So I don't know if the DuPont is the right award for you on this case. I don't know how high it can go, but Kevin, you have knocked this out of the park with your research and the diligence that you did on this case. And it's an amazing story. And sincerely, everybody in Detroit's got to be proud of having you in Detroit telling the story. So what's next for you? What other big cases, if you can tell us?
that's the beauty of being from Detroit, working in Detroit, working in your home city. There is never any shortage of cases to cover. As you know, I'll be chasing you down, trying to get a hint of where the Flint water investigation's going. So
I just try to keep my head really low.
If you're looking at your rearview mirror, I'm hanging out.
Yeah. Well. I always look out for you, and I can't tell you how thankful I am for having you on tonight and our listeners. It always goes up when we have people like you and you on the show talking about stories like this. So thank you.
You're welcome. And it's important that, you know, we're not saying that Rick Borshi is innocent and incarcerated wrongly. It's just when you've done your time, you've done your time, and 29 years is way too long for a nonviolent juvenile offender. And I think he's going to get paroled. I think Hollywood is going to tell this story, and people are going to be talking a lot about Michigan and the parole system and if changes need to be made and how it works. That's what we're here for, checks and balances.
You know, I got to tell you, I've prosecuted several people when I was in the prosecutor's office. I won't forget Chelso Echeverria as long as I live, of prosecuting him for over 650 with delivery, and now he's still in prison. And the amount of damage he did. But there were so many cases. I can't tell you how many cases there were that ultimately, because there was two statutes, one was 650 grams with possession and intent to deliver, and then there was just the possession, and the possession was a parolable offense. There were so many of those cases that were reduced, got to possession, and they didn't serve as much time as this young man has. And there's something, you know, visceral, palatable, that you can see, taste, feel, that there's something wrong with this term. I think ultimately it seems like there may have been agendas that have caused him to stay in longer than many others. But hopefully the parole board gives a fair and honest hearing, and that justice can be done. And a lot of thanks has to go out there to you and everyone else that has fought for the Constitution and the fight. So my hat's off to you, my friend.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
All right. Be well. All right. So there we have it. You know, it's a fascinating story. And it's one of those stories where you can't make it up. And there's something that where you take a young boy, 13 years of age, and put him into the pit of crime and dealing drugs and use him, and then turn around and don't give him any hope. And he ends up back into the trade for which he's been trained. I don't know, something wrong with that story. And I'm hoping everything, the truth comes out and fairness happens. So we'll be back with Behind the Bench next month. And we'll have another special guest. We're trying to get Dr. Reed on, Akil Reed Amir from Yale. He teaches con law, and to talk to us about all of the happening and going on in Washington, D.C. So till then, we'll be back with Behind the Bench next month.